This podcast is brought to you by the Transitional Justice Institute at Ulster University. Learn more about our work, including our taught postgraduate programmes in gender, conflict, transitional justice and human rights, at www.transitionaljustice.ulster.ac.uk.
Welcome back, everyone. Thank you for joining us here for the first of the thematic panels of this workshop. We've got the discussions have got off to a wonderful start, so I'm delighted that we can give some space to the particular theme of family and relationship issues as they fall under CEDAW. There's been a little bit of a change of personnel on this panel. There's been a few last minute change of personnel, in fact. But I just want to, before I introduce our wonderful speakers, just say a word about why I think that this theme is really central to our thinking as organisers and to some of the issues that CEDAW faces. I mean, feminists have always sort of recognised the artificiality of the public-private distinction and the importance of family life, and for some feminist, relationships of care have really been central to their thinking. I've been reading Sarah Ahmed recently, and she's really shaped my thinking on the importance of the creation of home and relationships of care for lesbian women in particular. I think that really explains, I think, some of the focus that I've had, even intuitively, without understanding why, since the very start of my master's study into human rights, why relationships have formed the heart of that thinking, and how, what kind of obligations international human rights law may place on states with respect to relationships that we build that sustain us and making those relationships possible. But it's incredibly complicated. We've touched on a lot of these issues in the first panel, and I think this panel really gives us an opportunity to dig down into some of those questions of difference and diversity, plurality, questions of religion as well that come into play here when we begin to think about relationships, as well as questions of the plurality of gender as well that come into play. Some of the questions that have already risen touch on the different approaches that even within states that can emerge, and which we've experienced in the United Kingdom. So what we've, and I think for my money, I think this is an area in which CEDAW has a really important contribution to make and a lot more to say. There's a lot more room that could be given to the question of relationship recognition. We've got I don't know whether we can think of it in terms of progress or whether that's too much, that exposes too much of a Western bias when we think about this, but we're certainly seeing before other tribunals a kind of the question of decriminalisation as a starting point, and then leading up to formal recognition of relationships through marriage, addressing questions of parenthood as well, the positive obligations on states to enable individuals to create the family relationships that they want, and to have those relationships supported and sustained through the state, because the state does a huge amount of work through its laws and structures in supporting family relationships. So these are some of the questions that we're going to touch on. We've unfortunately we're missing out today on Rosanna Flamer Caldera's contribution. She's been indisposed at the last minute, which I know I was really looking forward to hearing what Rosanna had to say. She's been working tirelessly in Sri Lanka for LGBTIQ equality. And she has been spearheading litigation campaigns there that include an international dimension. Hopefully she'll be able to, I'm putting words in her mouth when I say I would personally hope she can join us for late for tomorrow's discussion, but I've no idea whether that will be possible or not. We do have with us, I'm really delighted to say, Danielle Roberts. She's Policy and Development Officer here in Northern Ireland. which is a community organisation that empowers, supports, and advocates for lesbian and bisexual women and their families. Danielle is a qualified solicitor and also a long-term activist as well. Joining Danielle presenting today is Imani Kamiri, who's head of legal affairs at the National Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission of Kenya. The commission is an organisation that is heavily involved in advocacy work, including the Repeal 162 campaign, referring to Section 160 and Section 165 of the Penal Code that criminalises same-sex relationships. The advocacy campaigns that they spearhead are both national and international. So, again, I'm really looking forward to the contribution that Imani brings to us today and the perspective that both her and Danielle bring. And I'm equally really looking forward to the discussions we can have. There'll be plenty of space for discussions after these two presentations. But I think that's more than enough from me. I'm going to, if it's okay with Danielle, she's been put on the spot a little bit, but if it's okay to start with her, then I'm delighted to hand over to Danielle Roberts. Thank you, Danielle.
Thanks very much. As well as an activist and a policy development officer, I'm also an ongoing PhD student at TGI. So several hats to choose from. So I'm going to speak a bit about the current situation for families in Northern Ireland. So I'm going to speak a bit about our marriage laws, which recently changed, which was good news, and our parental rights, and then I'm going to speak a bit about outstanding issues that we have. I am sharing my screen, so I can't see the chat while I'm doing that, but hopefully if you have any questions, you can pop them in there and I can take them up after. So here and I, as was already mentioned, as a community organisation and registered charity based in Belfast. So we have a few different strands of work. I do a lot of lobbying and consultation responses and advocacy to try and make the legal situation better for lesbian and bi women. We have a family support worker, a children's empowerment officer, is her proper title, who runs a family group for same-sex parents and also a group for children of same-sex parents. So it's a group around building resilience and empowering children whose parents are LGBT. And we also jointly with Cara Friend have a gender-based violence support worker who works with LGBT women and girls who are at risk of or who have experienced gender-based violence. So we have a few different things going on. On top of that, we deliver training, we have a range of peer support groups, we have a lot of social groups, so there's quite a lot happening, whether there's a pandemic or not. So to start off with, talking about the legal status of relationships in Northern Ireland, 2020 was a big year for change. From October 2019, if you're not familiar with Northern Ireland government, we have several crises. The devolved government in Northern Ireland was collapsed for 3 years, and before it came back, Westminster, as the body with obligation for upholding our human rights, stepped in to take action on two issues, one being marriage equality and the other being abortion access. So that came in October 2019. By the time consultations were underway and paperwork was all sorted out, we introduced civil marriage ceremonies in February 2020. So it was just around Valentine's Day, which was quite nice. Then religious marriage ceremonies came later, and civil partnerships are still available. So these are now available to people of opposite genders or the same gender. So the choice is there for heterosexual couples to enter into a civil partnership as well, as same-sex couples to enter into a marriage, whether that's a religious or a civil ceremony. We also got conversion of civil partnerships to marriage towards the end of 2020. So now people who were in a civil partnership can convert that to a marriage if they choose, or they can continue with their civil partnership. So that has various benefits, including international recognition. Some of our members are in relationships with people from countries who where they didn't recognise civil partnership. So for example, if you were from the UK and married to somebody from France, France didn't recognise a civil partnership. They'd only recognise the marriage. So so that has had some real legal benefits. One issue that we still have is that we don't have legal recognition of non-binary people, so there's no way for somebody to be to legally declare that their gender is non-binary. So the legislation does all talk about men and women. Now thinking about LGBT plus families, so I'm going to talk about a few different paths to parenthood. So adoption, surrogacy and assisted conception, focusing on assisted conception through a licensed clinic, whether that's NHS or privately funded, but not so much donor insemination, because it doesn't confer the same legal rights. So adoption, after a few legal challenges, a Court of Appeal ruling in 2013 put in place that same-sex couples were able to adopt whether they were in a civil partnership or not, which was at the time marriage wasn't available. So currently the process is exactly the same for heterosexual couples, same-sex couples and single people, and there have been a number of children placed with same-sex couples. And we have heard good reports of people feeling that they're treated the same way and scrutinised the same way as any other couple would be. So that has been a positive development. Looking at assisted conception, so IVF and IUI, lesbian couples who are civil partners or married at the time of conception automatically are both considered legally the parents in Northern Ireland. If they're not civil partners or married at the time of conception, but conceived through a licensed clinic, then there's some paperwork to be filled in, but both can be considered legally mothers of the child from the time of conception. So this is full parental rights, just the same as a heterosexual couple who had conceived without assistance or with assisted conception. So this only applies through where the conception is through a licensed clinic, so either NHS or privately funded. It doesn't apply to home insemination. So if somebody uses a sperm donated by a friend or family member and self-inseminates at home, that doesn't confer any legal rights onto the non-birth parent. They would have to adopt the child, and the sperm donor isn't really classed as a sperm donor. They're classed as the father and can be on the birth certificate. So we would never recommend that people go down a home insemination route, because legally it can be very messy. Surrogacy is currently under review, but it's not quite as clear cut. Whenever a woman who's a surrogate gives birth, she is legally the mother. And if she has a civil partner or a spouse, they are automatically treated as the second parent until a parental order is made. So that is currently under review, but at the minute, with surrogacy, there is a court order after birth to transfer parental rights. Northern Ireland doesn't have a lot of surrogacy happening within Northern Ireland, but there are people who travel elsewhere to make use of surrogacy arrangements. So that's something that we're going to have to keep an eye on whenever the law is reviewed, and it's also something that our healthcare professionals currently aren't being really trained on. So it's a bit of a gap in knowledge in Northern Ireland that is something that might come up more in the near future. So that's some rights that we have achieved, but there's not everything has been won. So I've mentioned assisted conception, and that both mothers are legally parents through assisted conception in the examples I've given before. But there isn't an equality of access for lesbian couples as well as heterosexual couples. There's a requirement that you try unsuccessfully for a year before you get IVF treatment. And in some cases, that's been interpreted for a lesbian couple as meaning you have to have private treatment for a year unsuccessfully before you can get NHS-funded treatment. That's not equality of access. A lesbian couple trying unsuccessfully for a year is going to be either a very expensive process or one where they'll have to engage in risky behaviour health-wise and legally. There's also recently there's been regulations introduced for donor IUI, so intrauterine insemination, which is less invasive than IVF and would be more appropriate for quite a few lesbian couples. However, the funding that was allocated would only allow for 5 couples a year to go through treatment. So that's not, it's not sustainable, and it's certainly not adequate. While in Northern Ireland, both mothers are treated as legal parents on the named on the birth certificate with full parental rights, this isn't the case in the Republic of Ireland, where in most circumstances only the person who gives birth is recognised as the mother. This has, as well as massive emotional issues, it also has legal implications. For example, if a child is born outside the island of Ireland to a birth mother who is English and a non-birth mother who is from Northern Ireland and therefore entitled to Irish citizenship, the birth certificate will name both parents, but the Irish government will only consider the birth parent. So because she is English, the Irish citizenship can't pass to the child. And we've had a number of people who have had issues getting an Irish passport, who have been flat out rejected, and even one who has been told their passport was issued in error because the Irish government doesn't recognise both parents as legally being parents. This has issues for our friends in the South. Equality for Children are currently campaigning on this issue, and I would encourage you to look out for any articles by them, because they are certainly more of an expert on it than I am. But there is a real issue of lack of recognition for same-sex parents by the Irish government, and that seeps in to people who engage with Here and I, because in Northern Ireland, we by right, we can be British, Irish or both, but at the minute, that right isn't afforded to all the children of people who are entitled to Irish citizenship. Gender-based violence legislation, Northern Ireland is pretty behind the rest of the UK when it comes to gender-based violence legislation. We are currently in the process of a stocking bill going through. We don't have upskirting legislation. We're working on strangulation as a standalone offence legislation. So there's a lot of work going on gender-based violence legislation, and we are trying to make sure that includes where perpetrators are in a lesbian relationship as well, that it's not a heteronormative assumption, and that there's support and targeted and adequate support available for LGBT people who are victims or survivors of gender-based violence. There's also a number of social inclusion strategies currently working through Stormont. I did mention that Stormont does go through periods of crisis. We're hoping that we aren't about to have another one. We're in a position where we're waiting to find out who the next First Minister is going to be. But hopefully, all being well, Stormont will not collapse and the social inclusion strategies will continue to be developed. So we have, there's one on poverty and one on disability. And then here and I sits on the co-design groups for the gender equality strategy and what's currently called the LGBTQI plus strategy. So we are hopefully going to go some way to having recommendations for government and measures to hold them to account. Potential things that CEDAW could consider. We've had really great success with CEDAW in Northern Ireland on access to abortion in particular. The CEDAW inquiry found that there was a grave and substantial violation of human rights because of the position where people were forced to travel for an abortion or to carry a pregnancy to term. So those recommendations from CEDAW were massively helpful for judicial reviews and later for legislation being developed. Other issues that for LGBT people, particularly LGBT young people, that are very pertinent are access to education and access to healthcare. Another issue, which is one that I know has been popping off in the chat box a wee bit, is the use of language, gender neutral or non-binary language. I don't have an answer. I think it's important that we keep talking about women. When we talk about abortion access in particular, we talk about women and pregnant people because not everybody who can and will get pregnant is a woman, but there's also particular impacts of misogyny. So yeah, I know, why not both is a bit of a cliche, I guess, but yeah, should we use gender neutral language or non-binary language? But then how do we also center women and tackle misogyny? So I don't have an answer, but I guess it's a discussion that's probably gonna go on for a while. The reason I've picked out education and health are, these are some statistics, I'm not gonna go through them all, but one of the key ones is that two-thirds of young people in Northern Ireland, LGBT young people, didn't feel that they were welcomed or valued within school. That's massive. And almost half of LGBT young people didn't feel like school was safe for them. This is research conducted by our own Department of Education. So there are massive issues with accessing education for LGBT young people. And then mental health and LGBT people. Mental health levels in Northern Ireland, or there's high incidences of poor mental health. We are a post-ceasefire society, if not a post-conflict society. But if we look at the LGBTQ plus community, particularly younger people, there's massively high levels of poor mental health. Just to draw your attention to the bottom, LGBT young people are 3 times more likely to contemplate suicide than heterosexual young people, while trans people are almost 5 times more likely to contemplate suicide. And also 5 times more likely to be diagnosed with and medicated for depression. So access to healthcare is something I'm sure will come up with Alexa tomorrow. Our trans healthcare is abysmal. I'm not going to speak about that today, but as well as access to reproductive healthcare, including assisted conception and abortion access, mental health and trans health are all massively under-resourced, and people aren't getting the care that they have a right to. Just to end on a positive note, the successful use of CEDAW. So I've mentioned the inquiry that CEDAW conducted into abortion access in Northern Ireland. And in 2019, the same act that brought in equal marriage also incorporated two recommendations of the inquiry report, which called for abortion access, and also combating gender stereotypes, particularly that which highlight that a woman's main role is as a mother, which is something that even our former First Minister was told by her party colleagues. And then also calling for comprehensive relationship and sexuality education. So in the CETA inquiry process has been used successfully in Northern Ireland to bring about legislative change. And I think, maybe it's something we could deploy on other issues as well. And that's me finished. So there's some contact details for me and for Here and I, if you want to have a look to see what else we do. Thanks for listening.
Thank you so much for that wonderful contribution, Danielle. I think it not least highlights for us all the layers of laws and legislation and the patchwork that goes on to constructing the family in national and international law. So once we start addressing these questions, it raises this whole host of complexities for us, and not least the one thing we can see there, which really jumped out to me, is that question that we addressed right at the start is, how do you create categories of inclusion without then creating the exclusions that follow from them? And that's, so you highlighted some of those exclusions beautifully there. So thank you for that really careful overview of what's happening in your jurisdiction. On this note, I think we're going to press on to the next presentation. We won't pause for questions just yet or contributions. If it's okay with Imani, I'm going to pass straight over to Imani Kamiri. Let's hear from you. Catherine, can you spotlight?
Thank you so much, Lade. My name is Imani Kamiri. I am a feminist. I am queer. I am also bisexual, and I am a lawyer. So I identify under so many hats, maybe not as big as as big as all other people who've spoken before me, but yeah, I really am proud of things that I hold and the hats that I hold. My pronouns are also Imani or they. And thank you so much for giving me this opportunity to share very, very shortly on what instances queer folks, and in particular lesbian, bisexual, transgender, intersex, non-binary folks who are perceived to be women face, and what their realities are. So I would allow me shortly to begin with the institution that I work for. I work with an organization called the National Gay and Lesbian Human Rights Commission, and our objectives are usually to promote and protect the equality and inclusion of LGBTIQ individuals in Kenya, and meaningful participation in society. So that would range from instances where we would participate in a strategic litigation, where we go to court and demand for instances that have been included in international laws and treaties and covenants, and also in Kenyan laws, as enshrined in Kenyan laws, so that LGBTIQ persons can have a wholesome life to aspire to, right? We also try in numerous ways to offer legal aid, civic education training, paralegal training, so that we are in a community of queer people who understand at least what the law is and what the law means to them, and means in which they could be protected, or we could be protected in the law. So how do we navigate the society as queer human rights, queer persons living in Kenya? So, and in particular to the session that talks about family as a right that is supposed to be, you know, enjoyed by LGBTI persons in Kenya. How do we go about it? So in Kenya, the biggest problem is, I want to say, the biggest problem is homophobia, transphobia, biphobia in relation to criminatory laws that are enshrined in our laws of Kenya. So we have these sections that you've had numerously spoken about, known as sections 162 and 165, which talks about unnatural offenses, where every person who is presumed to have carnal knowledge, and carnal knowledge in this instance is talking about adult consensual same gender or same sex relations, and in private, then if this person is convicted of the crime, then this crime accords them about 14 years in jail. Another sections of the law that are attached on 65 of the Penal Code are sections 11A of the Sexual Offences Act, which talks about indecent acts within among adults. So these are sections of the law that are particularly used to persecute LGBTQ individuals, and more so persons who engage in consensual adult same-sex or same-gender relationships or liaisons. So in an event that a person is even presumed, you know, or is presumed that their sexual orientation is different from what is perceived to be the norm, then we have the state and state actors actually enforce the sections of the law and take them through processes that are very strenuous and ensure that the rights to dignity of LGBTQ individuals in Kenya are infringed upon, and therefore ensuring that a lot of us are living in state of fear, a constant state of we are not able to interact and live as true to ourselves as we are. And what is the trueness in this nature, right? And in particular, in relation to Article 610. So I want to give you a small background of a strategic litigation case that is currently ongoing in court. Currently, it's at the Court of Appeal, but it's Petition 150 and 234 of 2016, which numerous human rights defenders, allies, NGOs, and CSOs alike petitioned the court to have these sections of the law struck from the law. Sections 162 and 160 talk about unnatural offenses. And we went through the whole court process from 2016. And in 2019, on May 24th, we had the High Court actually rule that the case did not bear any merit because the rights of the minority cannot overwhelm or overrule the rights of the majority, which is not a true niche when you're looking toward the rule of constitutionalism and the rule of law, right? Minorities, the rights of minorities are supposed to be constantly protected so that you can ensure that there's a democratic state where all persons are protected, right? And amongst the issues that the judges raised when they were throwing out our petition in regards to Report 162 was one such reason is LGBTIQ individuals would be seeking the right to marry, which in their opinion would be a detriment to the family as a unit, because one, it would, in their opinion, or in the societal opinion, it will bar procreation, because in no way or form would anyone imagine LGBTQ individuals would have families without procreating. How do you procreate? How do same gender folks procreate, right? Another reason it would be, and in the right to family, they actually stated that Kenya as a state is not ready to embrace instances where same sex and same gender couples can actually cohabit and live freely within and literally have the right to engage into a marital partnership, right? So that in numerous ways, and looking into instances that Kenya actually ratified the CEDAW Convention about 36 years ago. I think it was in 1986. And looking at all the my predecessors who spoke before me in instances where the commission actually, the convention was talking about realizing protection and anti-discriminatory laws towards LGBTIQ individuals. So how is withholding the right to marry or bringing about the right to be for LGBTIQ individuals to be in a marriage, you know, or in a partnership, how does that then realize the full intention of the CEDAW Convention, right? In other instances, you, when you're looking into adoption, for instances of LGBTIQ persons, the Children's Act of Kenya and Sections 158 clearly stipulates sections of the law and gives grounds to which people are not allowed to adopt or grounds of refusal to adopt, you know. So one such amongst numerous grounds of a person's have to have sound mind. If you're a convicted felon, then you cannot have the right to adoption, or a grant to adoption cannot be issued to you. Amongst other issues, they also mention that being a homosexual is a ground that a person who identifies as LGBTIQ cannot adopt and give a child a home. What does that mean? Does that mean that we are unfit? Are we clustered in instances where LGBTIQ individuals cannot have families because we are considered a ground, we are considered as our basic existence is considered as an illegal stature, right? So it's such an issue in instances where people have, you know, like want to go the step further and welcome, you know, they're able to bring about people in their families and want to bring about children who they're able to cater to, then they are barred by such sections, which for me is very discriminatory. And it also bars like someone's right to live in their the enjoyment of their rights to their full extent, right? We also look at instances where LGBTIQ persons in Kenya, by the basic virtue of us being considered as a criminality or a criminal beast, we do not enjoy the rights that are enshrined in Article 16, basic rights like rights to ownership of property, whether it's ownership that is passed off to us from families or our parents who might have had such properties, and in the form of inheritance of the properties is what I mean. And why would I say that we do not have such access? It's because the organization I work for comes across so many instances of people who have been rejected by their families because of their sexual orientation, gender identity, expression and sex characteristics. So they do not have that access to gain properties that would have been acquired to them through inheritance. They are totally weird. In instances, we have been totally rejected by our families, disowned from our families. So we are not the law in itself, you know, you have to go, there's a saying that they say in the courts, you have to go to equity with clean hands. So how do you then go to the courts to inquire of your rights to property, to ownership of property, and state that one of the grounds in which you were denied such property is because you identify as LGBTIQ, which is also such a very big problem, right? And also instances where we have experienced numerous clients who come to us and they state that they were coerced or forced to be in, marriages that suit their particular people who are forcing them into marriages because they were in one time or another either outed because of their sexual orientation, subject status, or and then their family, because of cultural persuasions and religious persuasions, then forced LGBTIQ individuals in numerous instances to be in marital relationships because they did not want to be subjected to the shame that came from people in the community being aware that their children identified as such. So you find instances where once the spouses are aware of such instances, it deteriorates to an instance where there's physical harassment and violence, sexual violence, yeah, which goes to numerous instances of corrective rape, and also domestic violence. But we live in a society where LGBTIQ people in Kenya are not very forthright in presenting these matters to state actors, because they know in the background that they are going to be further persecuted if they stipulated that one of the reasons as to why they were persecuted or they were in this instance of violence that that was occasioned to them was because of their sexual orientation and gender identity. So how does, in particular, CEDAW come to, how can CEDAW be particularly meaningful in ensuring that there's protection for LGBTIQ individuals? I want to say, like my previous panelists, what they mentioned is, yes, we should at all times be able to bring about instances and verbiage that includes transgender and gender non-conforming persons and intersex persons. Kenya has been very progressive in that we, in the past 5 years, have had so much research in regard to intersex people, to the extent that intersex people were actually enumerated in the last census, which happened in 2019. And intersex folks were actually enumerated as a different gender from the generic male and female binary. So there was the intersex binary that was, whether you're intersex, then you are, you know, known to be intersex by the government. And the government is also bringing about numerous policy and different policies based on people who identify of a different sex characteristics. There's also numerous laws and precedent that has been set by court, but in which the government or the state has been reluctant or has neglected or has been negligent in upholding numerous precedent that has been very progressive in regards to protection of LGBTIQ individuals, and in particular, and in instances where precedent has been set, then you find that, and it's particularly not only in LGBTIQ instances, but in general instances that also involve human rights, human rights persuasions. The government it's been a push and pull to have the state actually, you know, adhere to the pronouncements of a court. I think I'll end it at that, unless I have any questions. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Imani. That was a really rich and wonderful presentation. For me, the really important message that came across there was the interconnectedness of rights and the complexity, where we think that relationship recognition may be presented as a straightforward matter, just that the range of rights that are implicated in this discussion are just quite breathtaking and really demonstrated in a very clear way through your presentation. So thank you so much for that, Imani. I want to now open the floor for discussion. We have, as previously, we have some panelists here who are able to open their screens and ask their questions directly. For those of you who are otherwise on Zoom but not able to voice your question, then please do type them, your questions away. I've got the Q&A open now and I'm keeping an eye on that. So we'll be taking questions from both directions. So what I'm going to, how I would like to start is by encouraging our panelists here and other people who are here live to raise their hands if they have a question. And I'm going to kick off with Senya, if that's okay, because I can see she's got her hand up and is eager to kick us off. So Senya.
Yeah, thank you. And generally, it's such a wonderful panel and such a wonderful exchange of views. I have some comments on the both of the presentations. And the first one, which was about family and CEDAW. For me, it's also a question of who is the other? Who is the other subject? And because I'm also have like, I have different hats as an international human rights defender, also having a background in local advocacy and trying to do my PhD with the University of Leicester. So for me, it's usually like, you know, personal is political, and I can just share one story that happened to my friends, and that shows how sometimes the lack of intersectional analysis, including the analysis of CEDAW, could actually affect the real lives of people. So I have friends who are a couple of kind of lesbian couple, and one of the women, she is a cis woman, cisgender gender woman, and the other woman is a trans woman. So they gave birth to a child who is biologically connected to both of them. And then they moved to the UK because one of them was working there. And then they wanted to change the to obtain basically the birth certificate that would indicate both of the women as parents. And the problem was that the UK legislation that we would probably see as progressive, because it could recognize two women from the birth of the child as co-mothers. But the problem was that this legislation is connected to assisted reproduction and all these things, meaning that because in case of my friends, they give birth to a child in the other way, and the child is biologically connected to both of them. In this case, they were not able to obtain the birth certificate. The trans woman was asked quite intrusive and illogical questions. For example, from what moment you started to realize that you are a trans woman? And of course, it's not like you're just like one moment, one morning, you just like wake up and realize that you're a trans woman. So it was, we can think about, for example, the UK or other countries as like really progressive, but for me, the question is who is the other and who is left behind? And here we can see that actually the UK, yes, the UK adopted quite progressive legislation about lesbian women, cis lesbian women. But when it comes to the intersections between sexual orientation, gender identity, and gender, it's still the problem. And well, unfortunately, we were trying to bring this case during the country review of the United Kingdom by CEDAW. And it was not, you know, transformed into any recommendations, but that's just one example of how intersectional analysis could allow us to actually see who are left behind. So that's about this first part of the presentation. Second, I have also some ideas about Imani's presentation. And so I'm originally from Russia and I still have a Russian passport. And as you can imagine, Russia is not the most, you know, LGBTI friendly country. And for me, the question was always like, all this international law, how we can rely on this? Because like when our countries are not keen to implement the recommendations, do we actually need to spend all these limited resources to fight for our rights on the international area? And the second thing is, and I will be talking about this more tomorrow, is that the positive result is not always guaranteed. And for instance, I had a case related to hate speech against me, and I brought the case to the CEDAW, and the communication was considered as inadmissible, meaning that I was not able to get justice not only in my own country, but also in CEDAW. And as Mari Matsuda was saying about hate speech and, you know, all these minority groups, that when your government is not protecting you, you are basically a stateless person at the end. And that's kind of my feeling. But when you cannot also get this protection on the fora, which you would consider as like, you know, progressive feminist and so on and so forth, and you receive negative results, that also like, you know, it has also some implications. And maybe my question is to Imani is that like, how you maybe rationalize for yourself why you use international mechanisms, because I still believe in international law and in CEDAW. And for me, it's more like, you know, resistance, because we want to be the part of the human rights agenda. We want to be a subject. We want to be there and we want to form the agenda. And therefore, for me, it's also like the fight. It's also resistance. I don't want to be invisible. So that's how I am trying to rationalize why I'm still working in this space. Yeah, and you know, I just wanted maybe to ask Imani what the position of communities in Kenya, because I can imagine that it's also could be problematic for you. And my last idea is about like marriage, because, you know, especially in the feminist jurisprudence, the marriage and same-sex marriage was criticized a lot by feminists specifically because, you know, it's all patriarchal institutions and so on and so forth. But I also think that in part, it's it can be about this like colonial or post-colonial thinking, because like I am coming from Russia when we never had same-sex marriages or any protection for LGBTI people. And for me as a lesbian woman, for me, it's really important to have access to marriage, to same-sex marriage, and to be able to be recognized as my partner. And it's not, for me, it's not just to, you know, to confirm to traditional norms, but for me, the very act of being in a marriage, it's like a anti-patriarchal resistance. And for me, it's also the opportunity to build alternative and feminist universe in this marriage. So I was also talking to some of my friends from South Africa who was also kind of sharing with me that when we as, for example, lesbian women, when we created marriages, for us, it's not just confirming to patriarchal stereotypes, but it's also about building other alternative realities. And I just maybe wanted to mention this, that there is a lot of criticism of same-sex marriages, specifically in what we call Global North, because it's like this patriarchal. But I think that maybe for people who are actually based in lesbophobic, patriarchal, LGBTI-phobic countries, it can be a bit different. So that's kind of my input, and I would love to hear from you any feedback on this. And thank you so much again for organizing this discussion.
Thanks for that intervention, Senya. The audience will now get a sense of how lucky I am to have such a wonderful PhD student. And we'll be hearing more from Senya tomorrow in the final panel, as she said there. I'm going to ask Imani if she has a response at this stage to that question. I'd also, I will turn to Danielle as well. I'm particularly intrigued to, I'm not sure, I don't want to put you on the spot, but the question about feminist approaches to marriage was one that particularly caught my ears. I don't know if you have any thoughts about that, but I'll see, don't feel compelled, but perhaps I'll start with Imani. And then after that, we have a question in the wings from Megan, and I'll come back to that next. But Imani, over to you.
Thank you so much. Thank you so much for the questions. There were quite a few. So if I forgot any questions like that you raised, just let me know so that I am able to come back to them. So how do we specifically rely on international law? So we have a constitution that talks about international law as a source of law in Kenya. So all laws that have been ratified by Kenya as a state, which then form laws in Kenya. So in instances where we want to say, for example, go to court for an instance of strategic litigation, like the Repeal 162 case that I was just talking about in regards to unnatural offenses, then we cite
instances in international law and jurisprudence that are actually useful in that matter. So then it gives judges and magistrates and judicial officers a broader perspective of what to exactly look at and compare it with when coming to decisions. So it's very important. And our organization also uses international law as, I want to say, a basis of comparison on what exactly we would imagine that would bring about equality and protection of LGBTIQ individuals in Kenya. So in instances where, and sadly because of colonization, a lot of laws, if not all, actually, all laws that were in Kenya prior to repealing of some sections or, overhaul, removal of some laws in Kenya and creation of laws were actually adopted from the colonial masters, right? So all these laws form a basis of us being in a situation where we have to ape a lot, or we have to borrow a lot from people or states that have been progressive or have actually litigated or use legislature to change and shape laws that actually are beneficial to the society, right? So those are instances as to why we have to use them. And another instance is also in regard to advocacy. Our advocacy is not particularly targeted to the state, right? It's also targeted to the general public. It's targeted to state actors and the state in different ways, like targeted to the health, Ministry of Health, the judiciary, police officers, health workers. So we would use instances where we know that there's the general principle that international law and domestic law alike sets certain requirements that should be adhered to. And that's where we would use them in advocacy and changing the mindsets of people who actually, would create the general public, if that makes sense. Like bits and pieces of people, it's not just the giant. You have to do so much work within like numerous instances so that you're able to achieve the goal that you're going to. It might actually be something that is strenuous or something that takes a longer time to achieve a particular goal. But I think all these instances of advocacy in different instances make life better or easier. You wouldn't compare, in an example, you wouldn't compare the situation of LGBTIQ individuals in Kenya right now in 2021 to the situation that it was in 2006, right? So the law is still discriminatory, it's still homophobic, transphobic, but there are different ways in which policy may have been amended or created to ensure that some things here and there make life easier for LGBTIQ. How do we use international mechanisms? So we are engaged also in the regional community through the African Charter on SCHPR. And we also do shadow reporting for numerous instances of the UPR mechanism, the International Covenant Against All Forms of Torture and Degrading Treatment and Inhumane Treatment, the ICSCR. So in different ways, we find that missions are able to, issue recommendations to the state in ways that we, as the lay person or the layman, the citizen in Kenya, wouldn't be able to, because the state would sort of adhere to what is being brought about by different missions, as opposed to what the citizens in Kenya might need, because they would think that there are repercussions that would be coming about, that would come about in an event that they do not adhere to, recommendations by state. For example, Article 16 of the CEDAW Convention was actually ratified by Kenya. So, you know, there's a way, there's a presentation in which Kenya would be or would envision itself towards different missions, but does not, that does not reflect directly to how they ensure protection of all citizens' rights in Kenya. So what is my take on patriarchy in same-sex and same-gender relationships? Unfortunately, this is something that has been programmed particularly to all of us. And it is something that it takes a lot of unlearning. And I'm sure a lot of us are still unlearning these processes because there are instances, say 10, 20 years ago that people would not understand how women who are presumed to be both masculine presenting can be in a relationship. Then you would have, for example, cishet people ask, who's a woman, who's a man? You know, growing from a situation that we can actually perceive that women, whatever roles that they play, does not like have to have a construct of male and woman or male-female binaries or roles have been optioned to families. But the processes are usually very slow. And that I blame a lot of this on religion and culture. We are still based in a situation where, for instance, every 5 years we vote against tribal lines. Even if, like, for the previous 5 years, we would be in cahoots with whoever our neighbors are, but without knowing that what their tribe is. So it actually goes down to also lines that have been created, binaries that have been created based on people being male and female. And this is particularly so difficult, especially if you come or you reside from rural areas, then you wouldn't be able to even stay with your partner because of the constant reminder or imagination or the degradation that comes from the people who you imagine are your community because of your sexual orientation. The position for communities in Kenya, especially LGBTIQ communities in Kenya, is these constant violations that we experience, as I mentioned earlier on, that range from murder to corrective rape to you know, being jailed for same-sex engagement, to being denied even the right to have a family, to people being, you know, suspended or expelled from school once they've been outed by their families because of their sexual orientation. We see numerous people and stories on the media because we do media monitoring of children who have been expelled from school, denied the right to basic education because they identified or people presumed that their orientation was, you know, not the norm. I think I want to end at that. Over.
Thank you very much. What I that was just a wonderful answer. What I love about feminist engagement with international law is that we're very good at being pragmatic in the way we approach international law. We don't kind of reject it entirely as a useless tool, but we don't hang everything on it. And you really kind of talked us through some of that really, really well. So thank you, Imani. I'm just going to get turned to Danielle now. There's a bit of a discussion going on in the chat about marriage. I don't know if that's something you want to pick up or any other points, but I'll pass over to Danielle.
I think it's probably a similar pragmatic approach. Marriage gives legal rights that other relationships don't have. I think symbolically for Northern Ireland, equal marriage was massive. We are in a context where, I mean, listening to Imani speak about Kenya and things, I kind of feel like I need to wind my neck in and not. Yeah. We have homophobic politicians. it's not that long ago, a former first minister said if homosexuality was criminalised again, that they would hope people would follow the law. So I think symbolically, equal marriage coming in and it being thousands of people taken to the streets in support was massive for affirming LGBT relationships. But practically, it also helped address some things like trans people had to choose between either getting divorced or getting a gender recognition certificate. So I do think you can be a feminist and be married. I don't think marriage is what you make of it, not necessarily what it was historically. But we also have the option of civil partnerships for people who want to have a legally recognised relationship, regardless of the gender of their partner, without the sort of institutional hangovers of marriage. So yeah, I think particularly for things like, we know people who haven't been allowed to be next of kin for their long-term partner and to make healthcare decisions because the relationship hasn't been legally recognised. So yeah, I think it is important, and I don't think it's, I understand we get, there's plenty of discussions happen about, yeah, can you be, yeah, is this assimilation? Is it still queer? I think it's what you make of it. So yeah, I think you can be in a queer marriage. Yeah. and the legal benefits that come from it. Maybe we need to look at other things as well, like kinship groups and stuff like that. But to me, that's not material reality yet. So it's all a bit theoretical.
Thank you. I'm sitting here feeling increasing sympathy for the committee members that we have here and elsewhere and the challenges they face in delivering on some of these questions. So yeah, absolutely standing in awe right now of your role. We've got a couple of people here waiting patiently. If it's okay, I will stick to the order that I suggested and turn to my colleague Megan here to ask her or to make her contribution or ask her question first, and then we have Sandra Duffy. I'll come to you after.
Great. Thank you both for those great presentations. I have questions for each of you. Danielle, I'm wondering if you could talk through or just comment on the role of positive obligations in respect of SOGI and equal rights, because you can see from your presentation, particularly in thinking about reproductive choices, that it's great if there's no sort of a formal ban on accessing IVF or IUI or any other options that might exist, but if you don't have the money, you don't really have an option. So what kind of positive obligations are there for the state to facilitate or fulfill those reproductive choices, so it's not just illusory or just sort of on paper, but actually exists in reality for people? And Mani, I have two questions for you. And Danielle, you can, one, this first question probably also resonates in Northern Ireland, is just asking what kind of tools or what kind of things does the CETO committee need to provide as advocacy tools for dealing with conservative, religious, and traditional norms that are constantly pushing up against SOGI rights? How can the CETO committee position itself in a way that, you know, provides tools and arguments that can be used within your various domestic settings? Because it's so interesting, Mani, that we can see they're keeping the criminalization as a way to protect the family. And that's, I'm assuming it has some religious, conservative, traditional norms about what a family is. And my second question to Mani is that we can see from the earlier presentations today that, you know, the committee's been quite clear about sexual orientation, gender identity need to be included as a ground of discrimination. And I know in Article 27 of the Kenyan Constitution, it's not, I know it was very contentious in the drafting. And I'm just wondering if you could comment on whether there is any strategic litigation thinking about going in that direction, or if kind of activists and people on the ground in Kenya feel this is not the strategic moment to be bringing litigation to include sexual orientation as a ground of discrimination.
Thank you very much. I might just see if Sandra Duffy is a contribution. Well, I think what we'll do, we'll pass over to the presenters to answer Megan's, and then we'll give Sandra the floor after the speakers have just responded to Megan's. That seems the best way to do it. So perhaps Danielle first. if that's okay, and then Imani this time.
I suppose positive obligations under section 75 of the Give Right Agreement, there's a duty for public bodies to not discriminate against people of different protected characteristics with that. Oh, I muted myself, I think. So there are section 75 obligations for public bodies. But even with that obligation and regulations, the main issue we have at the minute for access and assisted conception is funding. The regional fertility clinics, so the NHS provider, isn't getting the funding, isn't getting the staffing levels, doesn't have the resources to deliver to more than 5 people a year, like when it comes to donor IUI. So, and that's for lesbian couples and single women. So it's not, and they're doing the best they can. They're trying to redirect funds from other bits of budget. But at the minute, it's not just not, it's not meeting demand, and people are going to age out of waiting lists, which is, yeah, reproductive healthcare is time sensitive in a lot of cases. And then I know it's not exactly what you asked, but despite the CEDAW recommendations being incorporated into the 2019 Northern Ireland Act and abortion regulations being put in place, our Department of Health has refused to commission services. So while we have law on paper, they're still saying they've got no duty to commission services. So healthcare professionals are trying to use what resources they have and redirecting them from other sexual health services without getting training and the support that they need to deliver services that we've been told, if we don't have those, it's a grave and systematic violation of our human rights. So I don't know whether positive obligations as well as legislation, so stuff on paper and international, doesn't necessarily mean we get the outcomes still. Yeah, which is why we still have to do some agitating.
Thank you. I'll jump straight over to Imani, if I may.
Thank you so much, Danielle, and thank you, and love day. I had 2 questions, and on the first, let me answer the first one. What is the basis of inclusion of sexual orientation or gender identity as a ground for discrimination under Article 27? And in fact, this is a very good thing that has come up. In Kenya, has LGBTIQ persons have actually litigated in different cases, as opposed to the one that I mentioned on Repeal 162, on matters based off the freedom from discrimination, freedom of expression, freedom of association, amongst other issues. And in 2 different petitions, and one of the petitions was a judicial review that was brought about by Transgender Education and Advocacy in 2013 through the Executive Director Audrey in regards to freedom of association for trans IT GNC persons, that's trans, intersex, and GNC, and gender non-conforming persons in Kenya. And on the pronouncement, on the delivering of the ruling, the judges in the matter actually included gender identity as one of the grounds that a person cannot be discriminated against. So the law in Kenya is normally shaped through different ways. And the High Court in Kenya is actually allowed to make pronouncements and make precedent that actually form the law in Kenya. So by virtual pronouncement that gender identity should be included as a ground against discrimination, that makes it that people cannot actually be discriminated against gender identity. And to the second strategic litigation case that actually went through court. It was petition 440 of 2013 that was taken to court back then, and then there was a pronouncement that was delivered in 2015, where sexual orientation was actually also included as a ground that people cannot be discriminated against. Now, the problem is freedom from discrimination is not an absolute right. It's actually limited. So there are ways in which, even if these pronouncements, different pronouncements have actually been made to include sex to mean, and sex and gender to mean sexual orientation and gender identity and expression, but state actors can still, you know, manipulate the law, and it can be actually interpreted that it does not, it's not an absolute right. Which is something that we still struggle with because of how progressive the courts are, but the practice is not as, it hasn't yet caught up with how, you know, the pronouncements are made in court. There has been numerous strategic litigations cases that have actually been won from 2017 in regards to sex characteristics all the way till to date, where people are, different people are litigating in court, but the general society and the general public has actually not caught up with the progression of the laws and the court, right? I think the tools that that would be available to litigants, and not only litigants, but people who are activists in Kenya in regards, and you know, all around us in regards to how we implement the CEDAW Convention is actually, it's actually, it comes into looking at how do CEDAW, as you know, how do you ensure that there's follow up in pronouncements that have actually been made? How do you ensure that there's enforcement? You know, how do you ensure that all persons are included as opposed to just being the binary of male and female? Because we, to be honest, like the numerous countries that are even more developed than what we would presume have not even achieved that equality. But how do you ensure that no state is lagging behind? How do we ensure that there's actually all of us, like you get accountable, or you issue accountability to states to ensure that there's something that is not only on paper, but something that is enforceable, right? Something that they are put to test to enforce and put or ensure that there are existing laws or repeal laws that are actually discriminatory and include them in, you know, legislation or just general government advocacy. Because you would actually have, there would be a stepping stone, or like I want to say privilege, that would be accorded to you as opposed to me, as I've said before. How do you ensure that you enforce these instances? Over.
Thank you so much. We have an intervention from Sandra Duffy, which I'm very much looking forward to. I just want, before I pass over to her, I just want to flag up that we probably have not much more than absolute maximum 10 minutes left. So I'm just giving the committee members here a little bit of a flag waving opportunity to say if you have any comments you'd like to make after this next intervention, that it would be wonderful to hear from you. No, obviously that's over to you. Please use the raise hand function if you'd like to make a contribution. But for now, over to Sandra, if I may.
Thank you. I'm going to be quite quick because there are far more relevant people to be hearing from than me, and hopefully some of the committee members would like to come in on these issues. I just have a really quick response to Ksenia and to Imani. With regard to marriage, and this is something that Danielle picked up on as well, it's not... So as both a personally queer and politically queer person, I am like down with heteronormativity, down with patriarchy, et cetera, as I think many of us would agree with. at the same time, I recognize that marriage holds a lot of value for a lot of people, both symbolically and legally. But I think I think we can't have a binary split here between, you know, it's totally assimilationist or we can be totally radical and abolish it altogether. I think there is somewhere in the middle where we, maybe one of our next human rights struggles needs to be, as Danielle said, recognizing kinship structures, recognizing different family forms. And I think something like that, something like a more progressive approach to recognizing family forms would also allow for things like, you know, relationships where the participants have different gender modalities, like the lesbian couple with one cis woman, one trans woman, who wanted to be registered as the co-mothers of their baby. So something, you know, maybe one of the things that we start to push for now that we have marriage equality in that in certain places, at least, is the recognition of alternative family structures and alternative family forms. The other thing that I wanted to bring up, just when Imani gave Imani's answer on on international law, is something that I was thinking about actually earlier when I was talking about language, is that international law is in itself a language. So international law has these terms that we use, and international law has these terms that are justiciable. So you make these claims, you can claim, you know, you can bring in, I have a human right as a member of the LGBT community, or as you know, someone who is part of a SOGI minority. I have a human right to freedom from discrimination, and it's recognized under international law. And that's translatable into a domestic legal system as well. So I do quite a bit of work on India, which obviously has a very similar colonial context to what Imani was saying about Kenya. The hangover of laws, and especially of the penal code that would have been left behind. And the progress that has been made in queer and trans rights in the courts in India in the past decade or so has been largely done through the language of international law, and has largely been done through invoking things like the Yogyakarta principles, like UN rulings. So I'm not sure if CEDAW was brought in, but I know the Human Rights Committee was certainly cited. The European Court on Human Rights was also cited. So it's very much that language of what is, you know, human rights are a justiciable context. Human rights are something that translates, and therefore international law can be, you know, used quite effectively in the domestic context, especially when litigating, especially. So that was quite rambling. It was basically, I completely agree with Imani on the uses of international law. So yeah, I'll hand back now.
Thank you very much. That was a lot more than rambling. I think it again brings us back to the way in which queer and feminist activists use international law and the utility that international law has. We don't, like I say, there's a tendency amongst feminists which I enjoy not to exaggerate its potential, but to try and mine its potential and to put the best foot forward. I can't see any raised hands here from any of our panelists at the moment, so I don't think there are any further contributions here right now. I don't know if either of our speakers want to respond to that contribution there. Is there a literal hand up there from Imani? Thank you. So Imani, I'm going to pass over to you. We are very close to time now, so if I can ask you just to present your final thought, but we're really looking forward to hearing your final thoughts today.
Yeah, so I just wanted to raise an instance that an issue that I haven't, and it's basically in regard to looking inward. So in instances where even LGBTIQ people engage in same-sex relationships or same-gender relationships, and their qualms that they experience within their relationships, then it would be impossible for them to even seek the right to inheritance in the event that their partners are deceased, or instances where we are occasioned with intimate partner violence, then there's no justice, that there's no redress to justice that is provided for LGBTIQ people because of a law that criminalizes LGBTIQ people in Kenya. I just wanted to mention that it's something that I hadn't, and thank you for giving me that opportunity. Thank you so much, Labdi.
Thank you. And Danielle, I don't know if you have anything that you'd like to say at the end or...
I'm just disappointed that we can't continue the conversation more because there's so much much to unpack, and lots of food for thought. So thanks everybody for your contributions.
Thank you so much to both of you. I guess particular thanks to Danielle for stepping in at such short notice, but thank you both for the richness of your presentations and the people and getting us started on these discussions in such a wonderful way.
I just wanted to thank all panelists for being so rich in their presentations, and there was a lot of freshness and thoughts for future contemplations. That's my pleasure to thank you.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Leah. That's really, really generous of you. Marion, if I could ask you to take the floor, please.
Yes, I too would like to thank the presenters for giving us so much to think about in the committee. The nuances and the just the extension and the imagination and the creativity that we really need to bring to this conversation, and the courage. I think that's that's really, really important. And so the contributions have been profound and certainly extended my understanding of various issues. And I think it really requires an imagination and a creativity and a political will to move forward to advance the rights of the SOGI community under the CEDAW Convention. Thank you.
Thank you. I think if that's it for contributions, thank you ever so much, Megan, for spotting those hands up. I do just want to give a nod to the other committee members who've been so generous in giving their time and joining us today. It's wonderful to have you here. But for now, I'll pass back to Catherine.
Thank you. Just to thank everyone again, and the only piece of housekeeping I have is just to say, please do come join us tomorrow. These discussions will continue. We have two wonderful sessions, and the links that you use for today will also work for tomorrow. We are recording all of the discussions. This recording will be available immediately on the Facebook page for the Transitional Justice Institute at Ulster University. And for anyone who's registered, we will convey the links to you shortly after the workshop concludes as well. So thank you everyone for your time and your participation, your contributions. It's been really, I think, exceeded our expectations, and our expectations were high. So, and to encourage you all just to come back tomorrow and have a good evening or afternoon, wherever you are in the world. Okay. Take care. See you tomorrow. Bye-bye. Thank you so much, Danielle and Amanda.